groups of emblems have been closely associated with sects and creeds that have made use of the emblem in one way or another in their teachings. And this part of the teaching has become so familiar that the picture is used to substitute for the reference to the factor involved. Religious emblems that we remember immediately, of course, bring to mind the Christian cross, which is associated with the most dramatic episode in the life of the founder of the faith. We find that in India, in Buddhism, for example, the chakra, or wheel with eight spokes, the Noble Eightfold Path and the Wheel of the Law, has become practically a universal symbol for Buddhism as a religious philosophy. It has gained the same general acceptance that the cross has in Christianity. Perhaps equally important in the Judaistic system is the sacred name, formed of flaming letters, which has also a great sacredness. Perhaps the outstanding religious emblem of the Jewish people is made up of the two tablets of the law, bearing letters or characters signifying the commandments. In Islam, the great symbol is the crescent of the planet Venus, which has to do very much with the development of their faith. And this has been universally accepted among Muslim states. Among Hindus, the most common symbol is the Omkara, or an elaborate device formed of the letters of the sacred name. These devices we generally recognize today as the trademarks of religions and faiths. In China, Taoism, of course, is represented by the yin-yang symbol, or the two hemispheres interlocking, the light and dark hemispheres of a circle. All these emblems have, therefore, gradually come to be identified with great systems of thought, and they become immediately able to stimulate in us a basic grand picture of a doctrine, of an idea, or of a way of life. These are the more simple explanations, however, and we must still penetrate into that field of research in which Pike was most concerned. He came to the conclusion that there was an essential and valid language of symbols, an alphabet of them, that while in various nations they were somewhat modified, still, there was a great body of symbolism, essentially sacred, and essentially dedicated to the perpetuation of knowledge without revelation by word. Therefore, the communication of certain secrets from age to age, from time to time, was accomplished by means of symbols, even as the ancient craftsmen in the days of the cathedral builders of Europe each marked his stone with his master's mark, a mark peculiar to himself, and being the same permanent record that primary man or ancient man carved so crudely upon some boulder. This record of the master's marks also extended throughout the world, for the same marks that are found on the cathedrals of Europe are also found on the Taj Mahal, on the Qutb Minar at Delhi, and upon the great monuments of the Hindu and Muslim world. Therefore, this practice of marking goes on throughout the world. And these marks that were on the cathedral stones of Europe are almost identical with the caste marks worn on the forehead of various Hindu sects, the members of the sects. Thus, this language of basic idea has spread to become perhaps the world's most simple means of the perpetuation and communication of secret knowledge, of knowledge hidden in cipher, in code, that these symbols form an elaborate cryptogram. The only difference being that instead of finding one simple easy key which unlocks it, the keys were lost in the debris of the ancient world. And Pike said that it was his opinion that these older keys would not be found again, that these keys had disappeared with the invaluable guidance given by the ancient teachers who had themselves vanished from among us. and that the great heritage of symbols still stands before us as the unlocked treasure house of knowledge, and that until we ourselves set to work to follow the words of Omar, the tent maker, to file from our own base metals the key that will unlock the door, that these symbols must remain comparatively unintelligible to us. Assuming that there may be a certain validity in this, and I think there is a very great validity, what are we going to do when it comes to our turn to attempt to penetrate these symbols? We have, first of all, to answer a simple question, perhaps, and that is, just what is the vitality and life within a symbol? Is a symbol a living thing? Is it a dead thing? What is this symbol? It is some kind of a formula. It is power locked in a picture. Perhaps a very crude picture, and perhaps with only a very few lines. But still, it is a power locked in a picture. And why do we say that it is a power? Because we say that in some way it is a truth, and that a truth is always a power. For a truth is the power which enables man to achieve his great victory over ignorance, in some particular, in some way, or upon some level of function or understanding. Thus a symbol has, we shall say, an essential meaning, that it has its root in some law. It must, because it is derived from nature, and everything in nature is meaningful. It also has, as I said, an accumulated series of meanings. And the individual confronted with a symbol is at first placed at a serious disadvantage. We will imagine that for some reason and in some way you have wandered into the ruin of some ancient Egyptian temple. And there, half buried in the sand, among the wreckage of time, you see graved upon the wall of that room, in strange deep cuttings of abstract artistic merit, a strange and powerful device, a symbol. What the symbol is for the moment is unimportant, because its name is Legion, but that it is an arresting device, we will admit. Perhaps it came down to us from Talamara and the strange pathetic reformation of Akhenaten over the faiths of Egypt, this strange mystic living in a world of symbols. But whatever it may be, there it is. So what will you do with it? Well, if you're inquisitive, the first thought you probably will have is to look in the guidebook quickly and see whether somebody of note and importance hasn't seen this before and has a nice, pat explanation that will require no further mentation on your part. So perhaps if you are more fortunate than most tourists, you will find it in the guidebook. The general experience is, however, that you will find everything else, that particular emblem, some way escaped attention. But assuming that you do find it, you will then find what Maspero thought it meant. You will find what Petrie thought it meant. You will find a learned opinion by Piazza Smythe, the old Astronomer Royal of Scotland who was in those parts. Perhaps you will find a very erudite description by Lepsius, or you can find a little more in Wilkinson's Manners and Customs of the Ancient Egyptians, or in one of the admirable handbooks of Sir A.E. Wallace Budge. You will get some kind of an interpretation, probably, if you look far enough. But what will you get? You will get the same type of interpretation that was based upon the learning or scholarship of that school of Egyptologists that has risen since Champollion and which has dominated the field ever since. They will tell you all they know, but what they know will be based largely upon Egypt. Well, Egypt in the days when that symbol was cut also had a great deal of knowledge about its own time. Probably it knew more about its day than we will ever know. Had this symbol then simply been a trite representation of something already known, it probably would not have been placed there. The Egyptian only put it there in the first place because it represented something that he could not reveal in any other way. something that meant something inside of him, not just merely the perpetuation of ornate devices which were everyday knowledge to himself, even though they may be extremely mysterious to us. So a great symbol was a great symbol in Egypt at the time it was placed on the temple wall, just as much as it is a great symbol today. And it is quite possible that thousands of Egyptians went by that symbol during the great period of the dynasties, and they did not know what it meant. Or it may be that it was anciently the wall of a sanctuary, where an initiated priest in his mysterious robes of blue and gold and wearing the great gilded triangular apron of his sect brought the neophyte and there attempted to unfold for him some strange and recondite meaning for this emblem. But one thing is sure, the emblem is not going to be easily unlocked. It is going to fight to hold its secret just as much as you may fight to take that secret from it. As Pike said in his little article I read to you, each of these symbols is a kind of sphinx, and each one who comes into the presence of it and tries to solve its riddle is also a kind of Oedipus. And this Oedipus must either solve the riddle or perish at the by the cruelty or the strange device which he has been unable to fathom. So we come into the presence of the symbol, and we realize that it represents design, that perhaps, like the famous old Etruscan frying pan, it was a masterpiece in higher mathematics, and that only by a mathematical code can we decipher it. But then when we have deciphered it, we lift a veil only to find other veils behind. How then shall we approach the symbol? Shall we approach it only with the hope that, or perhaps even the fear, that we shall discover that the Egyptian knew as much as we do? Will we approach it in the possibility that it may contain some interesting and novel formula that we can dramatize or fictionalize in our way of life? Probably from any one of 100 reasons, if we glance a second time, we will continue to ponder the symbol. What then is our answer? We have some reason to believe that it was put there by someone for a reason and a purpose. That man could know us, or would have any great or powerful interest in our way of life, is rather unthinkable. Man looking at the symbol is not fulfilling it. It is not merely intended to draw out of him the experiences of his century. It is interesting to see, however, to what degree this symbol becomes a drawing power and may also draw out of the individual levels of knowledge that he did not know he possessed because he had never before been subjected to a riddle. A riddle forces the individual to probe within the recesses of his own knowledge, seeking for something that at least has a bearing on the problem, or a clue, or some association by means of which the unknown becomes intelligible. But even if he does this, and he does it thoroughly and painstakingly, he only arrives at a certain formula of his own, passes on, his place is taken by another man who repeats the process. Each, because of different experience, comes to a somewhat different conclusion, and the symbol is consequently always a mirror, reflecting that which is within the beholder, casting back himself upon himself, but its own inscrutable mystery is still utterly locked. Therefore, this attitude is not entirely satisfactory. So the symbolist, and Pike belongs to that group, points out that in order to break the symbol, in order to actually penetrate it, it is not possible merely to make a photographic reproduction of it in our minds or to battle out our brains against its strange and fantastic construction. There has to be another way. There has to be something else. And that something else implies the possibility of the individual becoming receptive to the total impact of the symbol itself. Not only to discover what it can mean to him, what it may have meant to the Egyptian, but also what it really means. And this real meaning implies, of course, something else also. That in a moment of inspiration, someone put it there. What this inspiration level was, we cannot know. But if the symbol has survived as a great and magnificent arresting thing, that level of inspiration must be explored. We've got to try to find again the consciousness of the man who put the symbol there. This does not mean that if we do, we shall finally solve it. But it does mean that we shall come a little nearer to solution. We shall have a better grasp than merely imposing our own nature upon the symbol. Great symbols are nearly always strangely orderly, wonderfully mathematical. And while their essential principles may be obscured by flourishes and artistic devices, each one is based upon a grand concept. It is a cross or a circle or a triangle or a square. It has some tremendous basic mathematical strength, or perhaps numerical arrangement by which it has a strange and deep meaning. There is a pattern there. There is always an orderly progression of things. Thus the symbol invites us to contemplation. It invites us not to an aggressive effort to conquer it. It invites us to meet it in a more or less receptive manner, opening ourselves to it, persuading it to come forth rather than demanding it to come forth. It also must free us in some way from our own eternal resolution to read into that symbol our own meanings, or the meanings of our times, or the ethics of our times, or the morality of our times. What we must try to find out is what it meant. And as it probably arose from this great system of world mysteries, the great educational body of the past, this symbol may well be part of the great textbook of essential learning, a strange essay, a wonderful composition, placed there with masterly skill, not only to confuse the ages, but in some strange way to bind the truth seeker of the present to the truth discoverer of the past. Thus the problem of the impact of the symbol, the effort to decode it, may lead us in many directions. As Pike points out, one of the first things that a good symbol does for us is to show us how ignorant we are. And that is an admirable beginning for something. It suddenly reminds us that the common knowledge that we have is not very valuable in an uncommon situation. It further also reminds us, if we think a little more, that the common knowledge that we have has very seldom been sufficient in any situation. That we are dying of our common knowledge. And that unless we do something about it, we shall continue to die. Thus it behooves us to explore the symbol. And the moment we start on it, we are dedicated to the great course, the study of primordial man and his search for light. We must, to a certain degree, have the same experience which Pike himself had. Drawn into Masonry by the rather natural circumstances of the time, he became aware that he stood in a great palace of symbols. Gradually it dawned upon him that these symbols were the soul of something, that this organization which he had joined was not merely a body of persons tied together by dues. It was a symbol of something. It was something that tied into a challenge that could only be solved in one way, and that was by the attainment of universal enlightenment. That symbol would always be there, pointing a strange, abstract, accusing finger at the individual, solemnly pronouncing his ignorance, until that symbol itself was completely and entirely unfolded. And to search through these symbols is a very valuable experience for persons in practically every walk of life, because this temple, with its numerous and wonderful tracings, is only a miniature of the great temple of the heavens, the temple of earth, the temple of the world, upon the surfaces of which are innumerable wonderful patterns, designs, and figures. Men must read these figures and live, or remain ignorant of them and die. Life is just that simple. Either man must solve the riddle of nature, the riddle of the great Sphinx that sits forever on the threshold of the unknown. Man must solve the riddle of himself or die. He must solve the riddle of universal law, achieving an obedience which will enable him to live, or else he will die. He must either find the great principles which underlie all forms and appearances and cling to those principles, or he will not find them and he will perish for need of them. So our great search for these symbolic insights forces us to begin the long and perhaps arduous path that leads man from the appearances of things to the essences of things, from religion as a formal structure to religion as a divine revelation, from philosophy as a confusing path of intellectualism to philosophy as an outpouring of universal wisdom from the divine nature. These paths must be followed in the search for truths. And in the following of these paths, one by one, the superstitions and fallacies of man fall away. We discover truly that we cannot go far in the world of serious scholarship without feeling ourselves drawn more and more closely to the human need. We cannot search into the great origins of our knowledge without gaining a greater respect for persons of all places and types. The symbolist seeking to find the answer no longer lives in a world of believers and unbelievers. He no longer belongs to a world of those of the true faith and pagans and heathens. He lives in a world of individuals, each of whom is tracing the symbols of his faith and trying to find at the source of those symbols the certain and sure fact which is the root of faith. Thus universal knowledge gradually opens. And in every field of life, we use the symbols of our trades and our professions as ways of discovering the nature and substance of ourselves. Arts and sciences are of very little value if they're merely accepted for themselves. But if each is represented and recognized as the pronaos of a temple, a gate leading into an inner sanctuary of greater knowing, then even the simplest things that men do become emblems of the deepest things men seek. Thus the body becomes the emblem to the physician. The course of the blood, the structure of the muscles, the arrangements of the bones, the chemistries of function, all of these things are symbols of universal truth. To the architect, the laws of building become the symbols. To the painter, color, form, organization become the symbols. To the musician, sound, notes, keys, scales. All these things become the emblems and symbols of universal knowing. For everything men do is symbolical of the one thing that man is trying to do, and which he goes about so awkwardly and so often with such profanity of spirit. To discover these emblems, to unlock their secrets, then causes man to begin the long journey, the great journey into homelessness, as Buddha called it. This journey that goes on and must leave behind by degrees everything that has been established as a fixation, as a point, as an inevitable. One by one we outgrow our own ultimates. One by one we pass beyond the smug certain boundaries of our own particular worlds, to go out into homelessness, to go out into this state which is seeking only truth, and which cannot find this final form in any place along the path, but must rest a while with some opinion and doctrine, and then pass on into the wilderness again, seeking for that which is beyond words or description. Thus approached, the symbol becomes a tremendous dynamic, a way of leading all human beings into causes and paths of personal growth. The moment, for instance, that we take the sacred literature of the world and we look beneath the surface of it and we accept scriptures, writings of this nature as great works of symbolism rather than as historical works, we leave the smug fireside of the historical home ground and go into homelessness. We go into wandering. We go into an unknown world in which perhaps there seem to be no guideposts at all. But actually, we cannot help it, for the simple reason that no matter how sincere we may be, we must ultimately find any pattern of beliefs too small to allow for the growth that goes on in ourselves. Now, when we say that we pass on from one level of symbolism to another, Pike points out to us also that these levels do not deny each other. The fact that we have outgrown a symbol or left it like some dead seashell along the shore of life's great ocean does not mean that that meaning we have left behind is untrue. It means, however, that it is incomplete. It means that no matter how fondly we have embraced it and held it, we have not exhausted the symbol. We have come to some pleasant and appropriate acceptance, perhaps an acceptance which we share with 1,000,000, 10,000,000, 500,000,000 other human beings who also have accepted this acceptance and built their values around it. But this does not mean that this acceptance is ultimate, nor does it mean that there can be no greater key to the same symbol. Thus, for example, in our modern time, as we pointed out in an earlier course that we gave, in our modern time, we have to depart from one of the most common and literal of all symbols, and that is history as moral instruction. We soon discover that the least meaning of a symbol is its history, or the historical event or circumstance with which it is associated. No man can find salvation by reading history alone. He may contemplate upon it and discover salvation, but the mere acceptance of it will not do this. It is only that he can unlock history with the same dynamic key which makes it bear witness to universal realities. Only in this way can he find in history the great spiritual inspiration without which his purpose is in vain. But the literal, the historical, is the deepest and heaviest veil upon a symbol. And from this we must pass immediately, not denying the history, but denying that history will save us, and go on to search and explore the universal meanings behind these devices. Almost immediately, we do realize that we share symbols, that the triangle, which we use so commonly, I've seen it over the doors of countless churches, this upright, blazing triangle. We share it with the Greeks, we share it with the Chinese and the Hindus. We share it with the Muslim and the Persian. We share this symbol with other people all over the world. Thus, by the fact that we share, comes into light another interesting point. Great philosophical, religious systems of mystical symbolism are in many cases emphases. They are not separate revelations, not religions apart from all other faith. They are man's search for truth, held within a framework of time and place, and subjected to the environmental limitations of race, of nation, of political histories, and many things of that nature. But the principles behind these faiths are unfolded peculiarly according to the need of certain peoples under certain conditions and under certain pressures. It may well happen then that it will require all of these faiths and then more to unlock the meaning of the simplest symbol. It may mean that in one emblem we shall have to go through a dozen faiths in order to begin to perceive the law and principle that underlies it. Now, these faiths in turn may be exhausted, and we may still not come to the very essence of the symbol. Because the essence of the symbol, like the peculiar meaning of a dream, is extremely elusive. And as the modern psychologist realizes, these symbols arise from very deep psychic pressures within the collective or folk structure of humanity. But assuming that we have studied, that we have begun to explore these things, along this way of searching, we make many other discoveries. And in the search for essential truth, the byproducts are almost as important as the product itself. Because along the way, we gain admiration for our fellow men. We gain understanding of their searching. We gain inspiration from the great and beautiful truths that they have discovered. We gain fellowship with them in the simple problems of their living. And we move inevitably from a purely intellectual position to one of the deepest compassion and emotional acceptance of things that perhaps once were strange, difficult, and unknown to us. Thus, one of the great results of an honest search is the discovery of friend, the discovery of brotherhood, the discovery of the right power and purpose of working together for these great ends, which we have none of us yet fully attained. Therefore, it is not that one shall lead and others shall follow, but in the search for truth, we are all brothers, searching together for that which is beyond us all. Consequently, our small jealousies and our petty prejudices can dissolve when we realize that we all bear approximately the same relationship to the sovereign center of truth, that one does not possess it and is passing it out to others, but that all, possessing parts of it, are searching for all of it, and sharing the parts together advances the search for totality. So we go on in these symbolisms until finally we come to what might, as Pike pointed out, be the greatest key of all. Through learning, we advance our course a certain way. But the course itself cannot be completed until the individual himself, who is the truth seeker, recognizes the sovereign importance of so adjusting his own nature and disposition that he is capable of a knowledge beyond his present state. Thus, Pike points out the great systems of disciplines advocated in the Eleusinia, in the Hindu mysteries in China, and in all parts of the world. Namely, that insight, true insight, arises from conduct. That true knowledge is not possible to the ignorant until certain other things have been achieved. Consequently, the search for the symbol, the tremendous invitation of this riddle, the progressing of it along natural and reasonable lines until we are finally frustrated, beholding a great spiral staircase rising as in the wonderful Table of Seabees. Then suddenly the realization that we cannot finally come to solution without the total reformation of ourselves. That from our own natures, the eye must be fashioned that can see beyond the horizon of form and place. Thus in the Egyptian rites and in the Greek rites, the seeker after truth had to carry the small lamp of his own attainment when he examined all of these strange cuttings and symbols and pictures and devices. Without the lamp of his own soul, without the light within him, the meaning could never be found. So we come back to the simple concept as taught by Jesus and Buddha and many others, but with a new meaning, a new degree of value. Namely, that the truth seeker, in order to attain, must place himself under the laws which he seeks to understand. Until he makes this personal consecration or dedication of his own nature, he cannot have the insight necessary to see. So in the great structures which used these symbols originally, discipleship always preceded acceptance into the mysteries. Albert Pike gives us quite a detailed description of the great rituals held at the time of the Eleusinian mysteries in Attica in Greece. These were the state mysteries. They were the mysteries which citizenship in Greece permitted the individual to attend. Those who were born citizens, free born of Greece, men and women, were permitted to be initiated into the Eleusinian rites. The first or lower rituals were given to all who sought, and any person well born above the age of 12 years was entitled to receive the rituals. He beheld the great symbolic pageantry of this rite, by means of which he gained a more or less total impact of the great Orphic mystery, which was the spiritual root of his culture. Because everything that was Greek art, Greek music, Greek literature, Greek philosophy, and Greek religion arose from this great core of the Orphic revelation, the hymns, the mystical songs of Orpheus, the strange, secret, tender ritual of universal love which lay at the root of all Greek culture. But after the neophyte had taken this lesser ritual, he then had to indicate his future. He had to wait for years before he was eligible to take the greater ritual, for which only certain persons were entitled. He had to earn this. He had to wait for it. And his waiting and his earning was a matter of great expectancy. Some way he knew or sensed or felt that this other experience was a strange transforming thing, that to pass through the great rite was to be born again. And as surely as he was so twice born, he was given the keys of heaven and the great power over the world and universe in which he lived. But the priests in sober and contrite circle warned him of this important step. They warned him that this ritual, this greater degree, would only be conferred upon him when he had attained certain virtues in his own life. Only when he could honestly prove that he was no longer dominated by the ordinary impulses of human nature, that he was no longer selfish, no longer arrogant, no longer easily moved from the quiet contemplation of values, no longer a vengeful or worrisome mood, no longer envious of the success of others, no longer subject to the tyrannies of life, that gradually he had subsided and subdued these things within himself, that quiet, dedicated to truth alone, willing to sacrifice life and honor upon the altar of reality, then and then only could he enter the sanctuary. Then and then only would he be given the great rites. For strangely enough, as General Pike also points out, the supreme wisdom is reserved for those who no longer need it. In other words, this ritual becomes merely a symbolical thing, because it is by the path leading to the symbol that man gradually discovers its meaning. He gradually subsides these obscuring factors within his own nature. And as he becomes truly still within and has transformed all base values into the purest alchemical gold of transmutation and regeneration, he beholds the great symbol moving in as it moved in upon St. Hildegard of Bingen, the sky opening, the earth beneath his feet opening, the air filled with symbols, everything moving into life. And by that time, his own cleared insight shows him the kind of world that brings him to his knees in absolute admiration of the ineffable beauty, sublimity, and divinity of even the simplest form of life. And General Pike says, there is not the smallest bird that flies in the sky, and he was very fond of birds, that does not clutch forever in its talons the silken thread of universal truth. In other words, it is inseparable from nothing. Nothing can be divided from it. So when the neophyte, having passed his test, having become wise in the wisdom that is not of this world, having gradually subsided and subdued all these false pressures within himself, is at last brought into the presence of the symbol, the mystery of which he sought to penetrate. And coming into the presence of this symbol, he is no longer in the presence of a question at all. He does not say, "Now I know what it means." He does not say, "This line means this, that line means that, and where these two come together means another great and vital point. I am overjoyed. Now I will go home and live with my symbol." He does not say anything of this nature, because as the Eleusinian initiate learned, when he comes into the presence of the symbol, like Akhenaten before the great hand-rayed sun disk of the Aton, he looks upon it. He sees no longer a symbol. He sees no longer a device. He, as the ancient said, he sees merely the blazing form of God. All symbol ends in the fact that that symbol is a veil over the face of God. He is no longer interested in an answer, because the answer blazes into him. He is in the presence of the ineffable. He is in the presence of a thing that has come to life because he has brought himself to life. And he stands thus in the presence of the all-radiant, and falling on his knees, he does not ask, he worships. And when he has achieved to this point, he has solved the mystery of symbolism. All other things must precede it. He must remove the veils one by one, that behind all veils of form, of words, of thought, of meaning and idea, behind the last of these veils is the great face of the ineffable. And when man takes away the last veil, only God remains. This concept is the meaning of this tremendous vital search for the significance. It is the search for the Holy Grail. It is the search of the orders of the quest through the ages of chivalry. It is the end of the mendicant's wandering. It's the end of the Hindu's pilgrimage around the rocky base of Mount Kailasa. It is again this endless search for the Chan Shambhala beyond the sky. It is always the same. It is the search for the substance behind the shadow, and the wise discover in the end that divinity is the only substance behind the shadow, and that to discover this is to be one with it. To discover this is to lose the interest we have in the particular and adore the great gilded structure or golden radiant structure of the universal. This is our way. And each of these symbols is a little thread leading us through a labyrinth like that of Ariadne. And out of this labyrinth we must find our way, or else be killed by the Minotaur that guards its deepest parts. So man, escaping along the thread of symbol, finds it much easier to escape this way than he does through the heavy and clanking chains of dogma. He finds that dogma does not open him, it closes him. He finds that explanations, as commonly given, do not open him, they close him. The only way explanations open him, is when he realizes that this is an explanation, but we must continue on for the explanation. We must find the name of the symbol, and when we receive that name, we discover that its name is namelessness. It is a very critical and difficult thing for us to understand. But names disappear in the substances for which they stand, words in the ideas for which they are but symbols. And the world as form, the world as idea, the world as thought, the world as symbol vanishes in the world as God. This was the wisdom of the ancients. This was the old path. And this is the path that General Pike sought to re-engrave upon the hearts and souls of those who followed in his footsteps in the pathway of the degrees of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. He was seeking to remind them from their various stations and their various places, with their numerous loads, burdens, responsibilities, prejudices, and opinions. But this was the old road, the ancient road of man growing up by piercing pictures and going on to the material value which was behind them. That all these pictures are actually part not of man's knowing truth, but of man's becoming truth. That the end of the symbol is that man himself, as the great symbol, shall unfold. That every symbol invites man to grow from within his own nature, not merely by interpreting it, but by experiencing it. And as his disciplines increase, his vision increases also. Now, one of the simplest of all disciplines is scholarship, because it orders the mind, it makes things regular and reasonable, it usually dedicates the individual to some cause beyond wealth, for most scholars are proverbially poor. It causes the individual to create dedications that become very important to him. And also he gains a certain self-discipline by which he is able to advance further. Thus, through scholarship and through attentiveness, he strengthens resources. But he also comes then to another veil through which scholarship cannot pass. So at the proper time, he must cast it down, preserving only to himself the power of self-control which it has given him, and go on into another kind of dimension of experience, in which everything that he has seen from afar comes nearer. Everything which he has seen through a veil darkly, he may contemplate face to face. And this way the symbol strangely draws him on. It is like Goethe's eternal feminine that draws man ever across the great abyss of illusion. The symbol is therefore quite truly the great ornamentation of man's great temple of ethical growth. It is an eternal testimony to his need and an eternal doorway to the fulfillment of that need. Pike would then not be incorrect when he said that the great wealth of a society or an organization lies in its symbols, that these are its locked soul, and that these symbols can not only unlock them themselves, but they can unlock the souls of those who seek to understand, and therefore bridge this strange and incredible interval between appearances and substances. Thus, in the world of symbols, let us be mindful, and let us also recognize the importance of finding that in the end we may say, now I know. And then if we are asked what we know, we must answer, I do not know. This thing that is found as a total experience. It is not a discovery of a particular, but the tremendous impact of a universe opening, blazing its eternal splendor upon our consciousness and drawing us once more into the solemn and sacred union with that eternal value, that eternal life, that eternal power which is at the root of us. So we open both the innermost and the outermost, and we open the furthermost with the innermost. And as we unfold the utility, the mystery within ourselves, we see its blazing likeness unfolding in the symbol before us. This is the great concentration symbol, the great mandala, which locks the world. At the end of the quest, man coming finally to know, discovers not that he knows, but that he is. And in the attainment of becomingness, all mysteries are solved, all secrets are unveiled, all riddles answered. And these riddles are all concealed within the mystery of the divine mind and the divine spirit. And the symbol is the path that leads through itself to that which is beyond human comprehension. I think that is a fair statement of General Pike's opinion, and I think it is very well worthy of our thought and consideration. And we will continue our study of his work next week.